This is Sea Change Radio, covering the shift to sustainability. I'm Alex Wise.
The time that I place on when the Grand Food Bargain took place was about 1880. And within decades of that, we were already experiencing glut. So what did we do with glut? Well, we turned that to waste. And so just between retailers and consumers, 40% of food is never eaten. That waste is now destroying the very forces that gave us abundance.
You're walking the aisles of your local grocery store, picking out fresh ingredients for dinner. You get to the counter, pay for it, bag it, and you're off. Pretty simple, right? Well, that little mindless exchange was the product of thousands of years of human development. There was a time, not that long ago, when acquiring what you needed to survive entailed far more individual effort. This week on Sea Change Radio, we speak to Kevin Walker about his new book, The Grand Food Bargain, to learn about the ups and downs of all of this food abundance. We take a look back at how we got here, some of the unforeseen outcomes from this grand bargain, and what we ought to do moving forward. You may just take a step back and wonder the next time you go to the store for a loaf of bread, a container of milk, and a stick of butter. I'm joined now on Sea Change Radio by Kevin Walker. Kevin has been a professor at the School of Veterinary Medicine at Michigan State University, and he's currently an adjunct professor at the College of Agriculture at Michigan State. And his first book is called The Grand Food Bargain. Kevin, welcome to Sea Change Radio.
Thank you, Alex. It's a pleasure to be with you.
First, what is the Grand Food Bargain?
Well, the Grand Food Bargain, the best way to understand the Grand Food Bargain starts by remembering that our ability as humans to change the availability of food over time is the reason why we're alive today. The latest change that I call the Grand Food Bargain began at a time when it looked like America would become a nation of farmers. Instead, we became a nation of consumers who left producing food to others. What we wanted was more food for less effort. So this is one side of the grand food bargain. Those who went on to provide our food, they specialized in turning out greater volumes of food in exchange for more profits. So this is the other side of the grand food bargain. I remember going into a grocery store after living abroad for many years and feeling this sense of enormity looking at some 50,000 products on neatly arranged shelves and display cases. It's not that there were no stores overseas in Latin America, where I was based, but what the Grand Food Bargain accomplished was to take food to a whole new level of everyday abundance. I knew that if I walked out of that store, that within minutes, there were three other similar stores, not to mention any number of fast food and full service restaurants. This is the Grand Food Bargain. This is what we see and what we turn to when we're hungry and want food. There's also part of the grand food bargain that we don't often see or that we choose to ignore. And that is the grand food bargain that brought us unforeseen consequences.
And those consequences are playing out in terms of climate change and food safety and some other areas, I'm assuming?
Exactly. The more obvious one that's out there is our own health. And if we compare ourselves to our peer countries, we're near the top in terms of overall wealth, but we're at the bottom in terms of health. We eat more food, spend less on food, but we spend more on healthcare. And we're dead last when it comes to chronic food-related diseases like obesity and diabetes and heart disease. So you can put into that category meat consumption. I mean, we consume twice the meat that's recommended. We consume 2 pounds more per meat than what our neighbors do to the south per week, and 1 pound more per week than what our neighbors do to the north. So that's one consequence. And then you mentioned global warming. And because what powers the grand food bargain is the food system. That food system has become a primary contributor of not just pollutants in streams and waterways, but heat-trapping gases in the atmosphere. Not only CO2, but something called nitrous oxide, which the EPA said is about 300 times more potent than a molecule of CO2. So that's also part of the grand food bargain. So Alex, those are some of the more visible things that we can see, but there are also less visible costs as well. The grand food bargain favored larger farms and food businesses, which has over time helped to hollow out rural America. And it's led to fewer economic opportunities and viable communities, including schools and hospitals. And then there's one last example I'd like to touch on. And that was while we were busy changing food to be more abundant, food was changing us. We began to see access to food as a simple transaction in exchange for money. Our food now comes from stores and restaurants. That's where we think of. If we want more food, we simply bring more money. But it wasn't just that. It's also that the significance of how food was changing us either passed over us or seemed unimportant.
And is that necessarily a bad thing? I mean, it wasn't a bad thing at the dawn of civilization. This allowed us to go in and do amazing things like invent flight or computers, like because we've been able to kind of not been focused primarily on accumulating our calories, we've been able to thrive as a species, no?
That's exactly right. So what I said at the beginning, I mean, what we have done with food made all those possibilities real. We could go on and be artists and athletes, librarians or brain surgeons. That was all a result of having more food. For 2 million years, food and scarcity, that was the reality. They went hand in hand. We knew what it was like. And the grand food bargain was really our way of conquering food scarcity with abundance. And we did that through the modern food system. But the challenge that it brought about by creating a system, and this was a system that was based on our assumptions and our mindset and our creativeness, our inventiveness, is that as we became more attached to the food system, we also detached from where food really came from. And where food still comes from is from nature and the environment and a finite planet. So while we're focused on going to stores and restaurants and throwing things into shopping carts and eating, ordering off of meals, it seemed perfectly normal for us that food would be readily available, literally within minutes of where we worked, where we lived. We thought about food in terms of our wants and our tastes. We didn't worry anymore about needs and survival. And we thought about, well, only thing I need to know about food is the location of the nearest supermarket. And all that I need to do was bring money. And I've thought about that a lot. And I remember one time as part of my work, going to Venezuela. And this was in the early 2000s. And at that time, the price of gasoline was half the cost of bottled water. And from earlier travel and work in Venezuela and Colombia, I knew that at one point, agriculture in both countries was quite similar. And on this trip, I was fortunate enough to spend part of a day with a man who was well-versed in the history of his country. So I asked him why it was that food production in Colombia had flourished while the same had floundered in Venezuela. And he said that when the worldwide demand for oil skyrocketed, Venezuela was sitting on some of the richest oil reserves in the world. They had plenty of money. With money, there was no need to worry about domestic agriculture. Food could come from just about anywhere. As he talked about the bubbling unrest that was beginning to emerge in his country, at one point he said to me, you know, oil has been our curse. And as I've observed what has happened to Venezuela since, and a country that's still rich in oil reserve but's unable to feed its own people, I've reflected on the costs that food can have when we believe that it's just a matter of money. It's not just the presence or absence of food, but it's the connection that we build with food that matters most. This is the connection that gives us the most important relationship we have with life itself.
I went back home about a month ago to see my mama and my papa and the rest of the folks. When I got there, mom was sitting on the porch, just a rocking and a humming like she always did. She said, "Sit down, son, I know what you like. I'm gonna fry some funky bread tonight." I said, "Fry some bread?"
That's what she said.
The kind of bread she made was called whole cake bread.
In an inch of grease on a wood stove.
In a big old skillet.
That's the way it's done.
Yeah, yeah, right, make that whole cake.
Yeah, man.
Flour dough.
That's it. Yeah.
Breaking bread with my mama, breaking bread with my mama, breaking bread. Breaking bread with my mama, breaking bread with my mama.
This is Alex Wise on Sea Change Radio. I'm speaking to Professor Kevin Walker. His latest book is called The Grand Food Bargain. Kevin, because you're focusing more on land animals, and because a lot of the obesity and health concerns that we face as Americans can be traced to our consumption of meat, we leave fish and seafood out of the equation sometimes. And countries that have higher fish consumption, like Japan, tend to have longer lifespans and a healthier populace. But there's a huge cost to the planet as well for consuming all of this seafood, isn't there?
There absolutely is. And in fact, while our diet is more terrestrial-based and other countries like Japan is more aquatic-based, we're overfishing our oceans, without doubt. Not only are we overfishing our oceans, our oceans are reaching a saturation point when it comes to their ability to absorb carbon dioxide. So it's a problem that's not just present within the United States and other developed-based countries that are their meat is more terrestrial-based, but it's also in other countries as well. In our case, more than 90% of our meat comes from three animals, pigs, poultry, and beef. That's where we get the majority of it from. And for others, it varies. But overall, what we are doing at a global level is we are vastly surpassing our ability to provide it. In other words, we've gotten caught into this mode where we think that having more food somehow provides us with greater security. And more to the point, we start believing that abundance is food security. But abundance has never given us food security. And so whether we're fishing for more fish and pulling it out of the ocean, or we're farming and producing more beef, that's not a promise of security. And that's an important lesson I learned that I talk about in the beginning of the book. When I found myself in the Kalahari Desert, with no signs of civilization in any direction, and the only lifeline out spoke no English. That was a situation that a friend of mine and I put ourselves in as we followed a Bushman, or the San people, as some people know them as he went in search of food. And as the morning rolled on, he picked up the tracks of an ostrich. And as he followed the tracks through, it led to a clutch of ostrich eggs. There were multiple eggs, probably laid by more than one adult ostrich. But what happened next went against the very core of our westernized approach to food. After making sure that there was no immediate signs of danger in the area, he knelt down and studied with his eyes each of the eggs. And then he selected a single one and left the rest. So That's an important lesson that I learned. I'll leave it to the reader to go into more detail on that, other than to say, had he allowed us to carry all of those eggs back with him, I don't know that I would remember that event. But because he didn't, I came to understand why food abundance is never a guarantee for food security. Because while one lasts indefinitely, the other one does not.
And one of the problems of making these sweeping generalizations about abundance and food security is we are such a fragmented species in terms of what defines vulnerable. We may think of somebody who is obese as not vulnerable because they're well-fed, but we're now seeing a whole new definition of what well-fed means from 100 or 200 years ago. And then you also have real food scarcity issues all across the globe. And so if we were to apply some of the grand food bargains policies to mankind in a more sweeping measure, where would we start? I know that's a pretty tough nut to crack, but what's some of the, for lack of a better term, low-hanging fruit for good food policy for somebody to institute sounder food policy than what we currently have on the planet?
It's a big question, but let's kind of take some of this, unpack a little bit of this. First, I want to back up and just build on part of what you said. Because of the grand food bargain, we now live in this unique time where we have both overconsumption and undernutrition. In other words, our grand food bargain was set out to accomplish one thing, and that was to deliver us an overabundance of calories. That's the model behind it. And it does it very well. And in fact, we have basically twice the number of calories produced than what we need to function at a fully normal level. So that's what we're up against. The biggest challenge we have in going to a different level, in basically saying that we want to do better, is accepting that there is a hurdle, that there is a problem, and that the threats and the consequences posed by that problem have become unacceptable. And if we can do that, that is half the battle. So we were able to go from scarcity to abundance. But within a matter of decades of having abundance, we converted that into glut. And in fact, the time that I place on when the grand food bargain took place was about 1880. That's when when more than half of the labor force was off the farm. Prior to that, more than half was on. And within decades of that, we were already experiencing glut. So what did we do with glut? Well, we turned that to waste. And so just between retailers and consumers, 40% of food is never eaten. That waste is now destroying the very forces that gave us abundance. And what follows after that is a return to scarcity. So we're coming full circle. The only question is how soon will we get there? So that's where we need to get at when we realize that things will change. And some things are changing because you asked me that. So let me just give you a couple examples. Sugar in sugary drinks. Consumption of sugary soda over the last decade, year-over-year sales have trended down. Embedded in some of the reasons why for that are unneeded calories and its effect on personal health. The use of antibiotics in food production has ticked down for 2 years running. And among the reasons why that's the case is concern about antibiotics being used in food and as a growth promotant, especially in meat. And also recognition that it's not acceptable, especially when we get sick and we have fewer options that are available to us because of antibiotic resistance. Now, trends like this we have to monitor quickly because we have to sort out what the industry or companies are saying versus actual commitment to make it happen. But it's a positive sign. We also need to remember that in the use of antibiotics within the U.S. is at levels per per animal at 5 times higher than in the UK. You're seeing it in Iowa as well. I mean, Iowa is the mecca for corn, soybeans, pork, and egg production. And agriculture is the most important industry there. And yet people in urban areas, like in Des Moines, they're recognizing the struggle that their water filtration services are having to keep nitrates out of the water. And so you're seeing pushback there. We're seeing it as we've ended up having to go to restricted use legacy chemicals in soybean production, because as resistance to weeds has increased and the effectiveness of Roundup or glyphosate has dropped, the industry has rolled out the use of dicamba. And the only problem is dicamba doesn't stay in place. And it tends to be volatile and drift into fields. And those could be fields that aren't growing soybeans used with GMO seeds, but those could be peach orchards and other things. So that's raising awareness as well. And then we're having global warming. And all I say about global warming is, at least where I stand and I see what's happening, is I'm beginning to think that perhaps we're breaking out of the political filters, especially when we know that 17 of the 18 hottest years on record, since records were kept in 1850, have been since 2000. And when we think of global warming, we need to remember that when it comes to heat, crop and animals are a lot like people, and many just don't handle higher temperatures very well.
I don't want much in this life, just the simple things I treasure. Till I die, I would get by on fame, riches, and sensual pleasure. I don't ask much in this life, no special consideration. Just treat me like the new premier of a small...
This is Alex Wise on Sea Change Radio. I'm speaking to Kevin Walker. He's a professor at the College of Agriculture at Michigan State University, and his latest book is entitled The Grand Food Bargain. Kevin, where do you stand with technology being a turnkey out of this situation? In many ways, technology got us into this mess. We have exploding populations and well-fed, and some would say overfed populations, because of technological breakthroughs in agriculture in many ways. But I'm curious on your thoughts of the promise of lab-grown meat and other technologies that may be a silver bullet for what ails us.
Well, that's a great question. And you're right. I mean, when science came into being and America led the way as it related to agriculture and food production to set up a platform for science to succeed, and almost immediately we saw these big jumps in terms of productivity. So science has played a role, and we have shaped our future in terms of being close to science and understand that. But as you are saying, some of the biggest threats we faced are the result of past advances in science and technology. Where I stand is, and as I talk about in the book, we seem to be intrigued with the next promise that science holds out there that will take us to this next level and give it free rein without asking ourselves what happens later on. And what is happening later on is that promises of quantum dots or nanoparticles that will solve our issues with antibiotic resistance, or clean meat that will solve our issues with the use of resources and environmental pollution. We tend to take those on without saying, will that really get us there? What is the downside of adopting those technologies? Or, on the other hand, asking, what are technologies that are out there now that offer much more promise? For example, some of the richest farmland in the world was in the Midwest. You know, it was in the Great Plains. And the reason why it was so rich was because the perennials that were used there, the roots of some of those could go down 12 feet. And so when the winds came and so forth, that system held together. Right now, we plow up, or sometimes we might use no-till to come in and plant a new crop. But what there is work being done right now on perennials, on perennial crops, and what can be done with that. It's not as sexy as the other way, but it's out there. Our waste of food. What can be done now, not to use the waste of food, which is where some of the science is going, but how do we decrease the overall waste of food? It's not unusual. The farmer will go out and plant cucumbers, and if the price of those cucumbers fall when others are coming on the market, say, well, I can't harvest those and just leave them to rot in the fields. And yet we've invested all of the resources to bring it to that point, the land, the water, the petroleum, and yet we leave it there. Those are not the sexy type of science and technology that promise to do much, that are really attracted for, early investors to dump in. But that's part of the mind shift that we need to have. What is it? Amara's Law says that science and technology are overestimated in the short run and underestimated in the long run. And lab meat, or what I call clean meat, fits in exactly that. We've not had that. The promise is there. There are investments that are being made in it to make it happen. But we've yet to see any sort of discussion as a society as to where we want to go and what we want to do it. And that's another point that I'd like to bring up with science. And that is the role of science has always been to inform us. And when science was originally rolled out as it relates to agriculture and food production, as a society, we made an investment and said, you know what? We're going to invest in science to help advance society, with the feeling that as these results came out, which were free of requirements that they had to be marketable, but they would help our understanding and they would increase overall societal understanding. We've now transitioned to think science has to provide us an immediate return on what we do. And so we now look to science not just to inform us, but to make our lives easier. And that's never been the role of science. The science is to inform us. And we as a society have to grapple with, is this the path we want to travel?
Well, it's a terrific book. Kevin Walker, The Grand Food Bargain. Kevin, thanks so much for being my guest on Sea Change Radio.
Thank you, Alex. It was a pleasure talking with you.
Sway the future to the past and find what will endure.
You've been listening to Sea Change Radio. Our intro music is by Sanford Lewis, and our outro music is by Alex Wise. Additional music by O'Donnell Levy, the JBs, and Mose Allison. Check out our website at seachangeradio.com. That's seachangeradio.com to stream or download the show or subscribe to our podcast. Visit our archives there to hear from Bill McKibben, Van Jones, Paul Hawken, and many others. And tune in to Sea Change Radio next week as we continue making connections for sustainability. For Sea Change Radio, I'm Alex Wise.